seated. Court is ready to hear argument in 050171, Southwestern Bell Telephone Company versus Mitchell.
May it please the court, Ms. Susan Tidwell will present argument for petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. The goal in statutory construction cases is to ascertain and give effect to the legislature's intent. This court attempted to do that very thing when it decided Continental Casualty versus Downs. In Downs, the court construed section 409.021 of the Texas Labor Code to mean that a workers' compensation carrier who fails to initiate payments or contest compensability within 7 days of receiving notice of an injury waives, or in the court's language, does not trigger the right to contest compensability in the future. Less than a year later, the legislature responded to Downs by reenacting and clarifying the very statutory language that had been at issue. In so doing, the legislature rejected the court's holding by making it clear that a carrier who misses the 7-day payer dispute deadline does not waive its right to contest compensability. The problem that gave rise to this appeal is that until this court says otherwise, Downs is binding precedent. And under that precedent, Southwestern Bell has been ordered to pay workers' compensation benefits for an injury that we now know the legislature never intended to be compensable.
Well, what's different from this in any other case? I mean, we don't always get it right, but that's the way the process works. If the legislature thinks we got it wrong, they change it. We don't just then go overrule decisions.
I think that in statutory construction cases, the poll star is always legislative intent. So the crucial difference about this case and other cases is that in this case, the legislature came in and made some changes to the statute, which I have highlighted for you on the handout in front of you. And I think what this case boils down to is the legal effect of the legislature's decision to add provision A1. As you can see, provision A1, which I have highlighted in red, bold, italics, in every way possible, says an insurance carrier that fails to comply with subsection A under the statute does not waive its right to contest compensability for purposes of subsection C, but only commits an administrative violation for purposes of subsection E. Well, when you see that amendment and you read it in light of all of the black language that I have on your handout, and the black language is statutory language that the court construed in Downs and that was never changed. So the black language is a continuation of the law.
It was a different legislature that enacted the statute that was revised by a later legislature. Who's to say, not to argue against my own dissent, but that the court didn't get the legislative intent right in construing the earlier statute, and now the legislature has just changed its mind. And then a second question I want to ask is just a broad concept of stare decisis, and maybe you can help me work through, when should a court, even if it believed that it was right before, pay some attention to the fact that over the course of 4 years, a number of lawyers, litigators, judges, et cetera, have followed the court's prior precedent.
Again, I think it all turns on how the court interprets subsection A1. If the court concludes, as I have, that subsection A1 merely clarified but did not change the law that was in effect at the time that Downs was decided, then subsection A1, in effect, exposes a conflict between this interpretation of what this court decided the statutory
well,
language.
Well, it's not a conflict. It just overrules what we've done, in effect, but it doesn't it changes it.
Well, Your Honor, I think that this gets down to some statutory construction principles that distinguish between an amendment that clarifies pre-existing law but does not change it and amendments that truly change the law. So if you have, sort of a normal situation, you could say that, okay, the law meant one thing up to 2003 and then the legislature changed it. And actually, there were two provisions that were changed. There were substantive changes. The payer dispute deadline was extended from 7 days to 15 days. That's an actual change. The administrative penalties were reduced and made mandatory. Those are actual changes. Those actual changes take prospective effect and they go forward. But what I believe we have with subsection A1 is not a change in what the law was. It's merely a clarification of what that black letter law that we see.
Again, this can happen in a number of scenarios. And what this would mean is anytime the legislature, in response to an opinion, clarifies something we've said, we then have to go overrule our prior cases.
Again, well, to be frank, this doesn't happen very often. Most of the time what we get in statutory construction cases are cases that fall under the legislative acceptance doctrine. You know, this court construes a statute. The legislature accepts the court's construction, doesn't do anything. And then we presume that the court got the legislature's intent right. And so stare decisis, you know, demands that the court adhere to the construction that it's given. I think in this case, and again, to me, it turns on how you construe A1. Under the principles that this court adopted in a case that I haven't yet cited, but it's American Surety Company versus Axtel, and that is at 36 Southwest 2nd, 715, the court laid out some principles of statutory construction that are common. They're in the treatise on statutory construction that has been cited to this court. And under those principles, when a legislature amends part of a statute but reenacts other parts of it as well, the task of statutory construction that the court is faced with is to construe the old and new provisions together and to determine a single harmonious meaning from all of them. So what that tells us, what Axtel tells us, is we've got to read A1 and we've got to construe it in light of the language that was reenacted and that is, in fact, a continuation of the prior law. So what A1 is telling us is the true meaning of the prior law, which was the law that this court construed in Downs.
Could the legislature have applied its amendments retroactively?
Sure, the legislature can do whatever it wants to. I think that when the legislature in the 2003 amendment said that our amendments apply prospectively, it was referring to the changes, the actual substantive changes. You know, again, if the court is having a hard time seeing that A1 merely clarifies the law that had always been in effect and believes that it actually somehow did change law that was, you know, in effect for the entire time, then I think that the court can avoid overruling Downs by simply limiting it to retroactive application. I think regardless of whether the legislative amendments in 2003 changed or clarified the law, it is fairly clear that when this court decided Downs in 2002, it dramatically changed the longstanding administrative practice in this state. There were statewide administrative rules that, in fact, interpreted the statute the same way the 2003 legislature did. Under those rules, carriers did not waive their right to contest compensability as long as they did so within 60 days. And in fact, the commission even had a special rule for death cases that expressly gave carriers 60 days to investigate deaths because on the one hand, the commission realized that in most instances, it will be impossible to determine whether a death is compensable or not within 7 days because you need things like autopsy results, toxicology results. You need lots of medical results that are probably not even available within 7 days. And in addition...
But didn't they get 60 days? All they had to do was start compensation?
Well, Your Honor, compensation in death benefit cases is determined according to statute by commission rule. And under commission rule, it's not possible to just start paying death benefits the day that somebody dies. First of all, the carrier is required to investigate compensability because the whole workers' compensation system, it's not a pay now and think about it later.
That's no different than any other claim, is it? It doesn't A say if you start paying within 7 days, then you preserve your rights. There wasn't any question about that as to any kind of an injury on the job, whether it's a fight that they claim happened, anything. Isn't the scheme here, we want to get the money started?
Well, the scheme is that we want to get the money started, but the legislature...
And if you start the money, then you get some time.
The problem with death benefit cases, though, it is impossible to start benefits within 7 days because not only do you have
the
issue...
The statute says that you can.
Well, actually, the statute, when it talks about... It says that death benefits accrue the day after death, but then it says death benefits are payable as per commission rules.
We're construing subsection A that says a carrier shall initiate promptly, not later than you start paying or or dispute. So
and absolutely. Subsection A has mandatory language. It says the carrier shall pay or dispute within 7 days. And it's uncontested that in this case, Southwestern Bell missed that deadline. The point that I'm making about the commission rules that were in effect with respect to death claims is that the commission always recognized that it is, well, actually, under the commission rules, you were never required to pay. In fact, you couldn't pay death benefits within 7 days because you usually don't know who the legal beneficiaries are at that point. The carrier can't just write a check to the dead person because the person's dead. And so you've got to figure out not only whether the injury is compensable, but also who's entitled to the benefits. So there are essentially extra steps that make it impossible to pay within 7 days. Also, the commission wanted to have a rule that was somewhat sensitive to the families situation. You know, a commission rule that required a carrier to go in and make determinations about compensability within 7 days of someone's death would mean that, you know, a day after a worker dies, here's the insurance carrier on the doorstep trying to find out, you know, what the circumstances of death were. The bottom line is, under the rules that were valid statewide rules that were in effect until this court's decision in Downs became final, a carrier had 60 days to investigate a death claim without waiving the right to do so. Those were the rules that were in effect. According to the Labor Code, even when the San Antonio Court of Appeals issued its decision in Downs, it was the commission's determination of the issue that remained binding until the judicial review process was complete. So for carriers in the position of Southwestern Bell, they were following the law as it was given to them by the commission when they received notice of injury. They couldn't initiate death benefits within 7 days because it's actually legally impossible to do that. They didn't contest compensability within 7 days because they hadn't completed their investigation. But under the commission rules, they could have 60 days. So at minimum, we would ask the court to hold that Downs does not apply retroactively because it did, in fact, change what had been a longstanding commission interpretation. It established a new principle of law. And the record in this case clearly establishes how the retroactive application of Downs has led to substantial and inequitable results. In this case, Southwestern Bell was deprived of what the legislature has recognized is a statutory right to contest compensability for 60 days. Southwestern Bell, because of being deprived of that right, is now having to pay workers' compensation benefits for an injury that we now know the legislature has said should never have been compensable. So at minimum, we would ask that the court limit its holding to retroactive, hold that Downs does not apply retroactively to injuries in which the carrier received notice of injury before this court's decision in Downs became final. I really think, though, that the court should take a close look at the new subsection A1. I think by the plain language of that subsection, to me, it seems clear that the legislature is not actually trying to change the law that
was
already in effect.
So the rule you would craft is if the legislature clarifies in a way that conflicts with the prior opinion of the court overrules the prior opinion. Anytime the legislature clarifies.
Yes, Your Honor. The rule that I would craft is one that this court has articulated on numerous occasions. In statutory construction cases, the main goal is to follow the legislature's intent. If the legislature rejects the court's construction, I think it's incumbent on the court to accept the legislature's construction of the statute. This is, frankly, sort of the flip side of the legislative acceptance.
So we all argue whether it's a change or clarification. That's what it comes down to.
I think, for me, the whole thing boils down to whether A1 is a change or a clarification. If it is a change, then Downs can withstand the 2003 amendments, but I think then you have to seriously ask whether it can be applied, whether it can properly be applied retroactively. If A1 is merely a clarification, then I think you do have a conflict. And as important as stare decisis is, this court has always recognized that when you're stuck with a conflict between the court's interpretation of a statute and the legislature's interpretation of a statute, this court has to defer to the legislature. I've been thinking of it almost as the judicial acceptance doctrine. And I don't think that taking that approach does anything but to affirm longstanding principles of statutory construction. It shows respect for the separation of powers. It reaffirms the idea that it's the legislature's power to determine what the law should be. And I don't think that it suggests that the court has done something, you know, sort of improper by overruling a decision when all it is doing is conforming its decision to the legislature's intent.
And what if it's hard to determine if it's a change or a clarification?
Well, that is the key statutory construction question for you. I would say first look at the plain meaning. To me, when I just read the plain language of it, it is simply explaining what is meant.
I'm asking more about the principle in this particular case. It's hard to tell if an amendment is a change or a clarification. Then what would you say about the application of the principle, how it should be contoured?
Well, I would say the court is going to have to make that constructive act. We'll have to decide whether it's a change or clarification. And how the principle applies depends on how the court comes down on that decision. You know, normally it's plain language. You look at whether it's changing substantive rights. And other courts have looked at things like legislative history. And I think in this case, the fact that the bill analysis says that what the holding in Downs was, you know, never what the legislature had intended, I think that bears, it's not decisive, but I think it bears on that statutory construction question.
Further questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from the respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Alan Tysinger will present argument for the respondents.
May it please the court, I'm Alan Tysinger, and I'm here on behalf of the beneficiary, William Mitchell. Let's be frank. Unlike 20 years ago, workers' compensation law is a blip on the radar screen of Texas jurisprudence. But in this case, you're not merely being asked to decide something of relevance to Texas workers' compensation law. SBC Texas is asking you to revolutionize the jurisprudence in this state in a number of areas. You're being asked to overrule a prior construction of the statute by this court.
But only because there appears to be some, in my view, substantial change to the statute.
And that's critical. And this is what I'm looking at here. If you go back and look at the statute, the legislature said specifically, these changes are effective for dates of injury only on and after September 1st, 2003, and the prior law is continued for prior dates of injury. So in other words, if the legislature wanted to, it could have said, effective the date of signing, this is the new law, effective to all claims. It could have said that September 1st, effective all claims filed on and after that date. It could have just left the issue of whether or not retroactivity was constitutional to this court. But instead, it took that issue itself and said, we are not even going to go there. We're not going to make this retroactive. It's only for dates of injury on and after September 1st. That means that if my legal assistant today files a claim for repetitive trauma, which would be an occupational disease, then if the hearing officer finds that her date of injury, when she knew or should have known that she had carpal tunnel syndrome, was August 1st, 2003, then Downs still applies. And the legislature knew that and didn't do anything about it. So when the legislature had the opportunity to tell you that it wanted to change everything retroactively, it declined to do so. And therefore, the suggestion that this is merely a clarification rather than a fundamental change to the statute, I think, is without basis in what the legislature did. So you're being asked, and this is the revolution, you're being asked, the question I would ask is, how on God's green earth in the future are you ever going to be able to tell when there is a clarification versus a fundamental change? If it's only a clarification when the legislature continues the law in effect prior for particular purposes, then what would it mean to change the statute? And I think that the petitioner has no good answer for that question. Furthermore, you're being asked to issue an advisory opinion regarding a class action lawsuit that's pending in Hidalgo County. That has no bearing on this case here. You're also being asked to hold that a court of appeals decision arising prior to the operative facts of this case applies retroactively when later affirmed by this court, or only prospectively, even though it's later determined by this court to be accurate. And so there's a question there as to, well, if the Court of Appeals announces in a case what the rule is in that jurisdiction, then what would it mean for a case to be applied in a manner that's consistent with that decision? In other words, if the Court of Appeals announces this is the law in Bexar County, in our jurisdiction, and the Workers' Comp Commission, because we live in a bizarre world where the Workers' Comp Commission has the ability to disregard what a Court of Appeals has said until it gets on judicial review. In other words, it's like a trial court disregarding the Court of Appeals because the Texas Workers' Compensation Commission has jurisdiction only until a judicial review is filed. It's like any trial court would know, if I don't follow Downs, what the fourth court has said, I'll be reversed. And only the administrative agency would have the gall to say to the Fourth Court of Appeals, we don't care what you say, we're going to continue doing what we're doing. And so in this case, in January of 2000, the Fourth Court spoke. And if that's not clear foreshadowing of what the law may be as decided by this court in the future, then I don't know what is, and I don't know how this court in the future is going to be able to tell on that decision. Furthermore, you're being asked to hold the statute when modified by the legislature and limited to dates of injury prior to 9-1-03, itself applies retroactively to the case decided by the commission prior to the statute. In other words, for all of the hullabaloo raised regarding the retroactive application of Downs in this case, you're now being told that it's perfectly fair for the legislature to speak in 2003 and control the outcome of a case decided by the commission in 2002 on facts which arose in the year 2000.
There's been a lot of discussion in the briefs and MCI about unjust results because of the Downs decision. Can you address that?
Well, and I can only say this. The question of what constitutes injustice, I'm not sure has been satisfactorily answered to this court. The argument here is, well, it's unjust for West Africa to pay benefits that were not determined to be owed by the legislature. And, of course, that begs the whole question of statutory construction that we'll hear about. The other part of that is that these injuries were asserted not to be occurring on the job and therefore otherwise not compensable. And all I can say about that is there are a number of deadlines within this statutory scheme, as well as many others, which impose penalties on parties, some of them very severe. And in this case, the penalty is being imposed upon a professional a corporation that handled by a professional adjusting agency, which knows the law and knows how to handle it. And you're being told, incidentally here, by counsel that we didn't file within 7 days because that's impossible. We just couldn't do that. And if you look back at the record, the adjuster filing the affidavit in this case, underlying it at the trial court, said, we ordinarily would do that, but we just couldn't in this case. So you're being told two different things depending on who's doing the speaking. But there's under the question of injustice, the issue there is you've got a professional agency dealt the blow of having to follow the statute. And I'm not sure how that's an injustice as compared to an unrepresented claimant who has no knowledge of workers' compensation laws, having the obligation to file a claim within a specified period of time and to do being imputed with knowledge of the law that he or she may not have. And so there's no 7-day relevant provision for injured workers. The deadlines are longer, but still, in comparison with the obligations proposed to professionals versus people who have no experience in the system, I think there's a balancing, and I think it's perfectly just, especially when you consider the penalty scheme that's also at work here. And you note that the legislature, when they made the change in 2003, lowered the penalty and said, you pay that $500 to the injured worker, however much it is. And prior, that penalty was paid to the Workers' Comp Commission. And so the claimant not only had no incentive to notify the commission about the penalty, the violation occurring, because no benefit inured to the claimant for doing so, but the claimant did not have and still doesn't have the right to know the disposition of that before the Workers' Comp Division. So in other words, what they do with these violations goes off into a black hole in every particular case, and you only know about it later in the aggregate. And despite the legislative changes, as one of the amicus briefs noted, there were a huge number of violations in 2004 based upon the amended statutory scheme that gave the carriers more time to respond and either pay benefits or deny the claim. So I think that the issue of injustice goes to the question of balancing what the legislature intended and making sure that both the commission, as the party tasked with overseeing the system, and the claimants have an adequate remedy to ensure that carriers act properly under the statute. So in this case, we look at the underlying issue of the statute, and petitioner, I think they're right in that the real question here is, what is the significance of the legislative changes? And I think that the key issue there is that the legislature has continued the prior law in effect for dates of injury prior to 2003. So when given the opportunity to say, we don't think that Downs was correct and we want to change it immediately, they didn't do so. And I don't think this court should take the opportunity to say, well, you continued the law in effect prior to that as we decided it, but we're going to change our minds and do what you could have done in your place. The statutory construction here is the area where this court has said numerous times that stare decisis is very powerful and has its strongest effect. And so in this case, you're being asked to revisit a case 4 years later that was decided, and you're being told repeatedly that the fact that it was a 5-4 decision bears on the question of whether or not it should be reversed. And I think for the sake of jurisprudence in the future, this court should say that we're not going to revisit cases merely because they're 5-4 decisions and on the whim of a subsequent party. The plain language here requires action within 7 days, and the carrier didn't either. In this case, I should note, you're being told repeatedly about the impossibility of compliance with the statute. How that bears upon the outcome of this case is, to me, quite unclear, in that regardless of whether or not the outcome is a penalty or if it's forfeiture or limitation of defenses, which I like to use instead of saying a waiver, limitation of defenses, regardless of what the outcome is for violating the statute imposes this obligation. And I should mention here that I said in the brief that I don't think that there was a case that had ever dealt with the 7-day payer dispute provision prior to Downs. And I'll cite to you, there's a case, Vanliner Insurance versus Ward, which is 923 Southwest 2nd at 29. And that case had sort of a bizarre fact pattern. It was a no petition case. It had sort of a bizarre fact pattern in that the carrier filed a document on the 7th day. But that document basically said, we hear that you've had a heart attack. We don't know whether or not it's work-related, and we're going to look into it. It didn't pay benefits. It didn't promise to pay benefits, and it didn't deny the claim. It subsequently filed a notice of dispute after the 60th day. And so you may ask, well, what does that have to do with anything if they file it after the 60th day? The court in that case said, because the carrier failed to pay or dispute within 7 days, the carrier has waived its right to come back and contest compensability. And that case was sort of an outlier. It was a no-petition case, and it would have been rather moot given that regardless of the outcome, 7-day or 60-day, you would have reached the same result. But it's far from the case now, I see, that no court had ever construed this portion of the Act to require action in 7 days and imposed a benefit penalty on the carrier prior to Downs. The court in the Vanliner Insurance case, in fact, did that. The legislature in this case basically then acted over the course of the subsequent legislative sessions without modifying that. In Downs, the fourth court announced a rule of decision in the year 2000, and the legislature expressly declined to do anything about that in 2001.
So by its silence, it, I guess, supposedly approved the scheme?
I think so, Judge, Your Honor, and that's, I don't know how far we want to go with all that, because we get into authority mess of how many legislative sessions is enough, and what does the legislature have to do in the interim? Can we count on them being asleep at the wheel and infer some intent from that? But that's the case law that's out there, and so we do point you to that and say, well, that is something that you have to consider, especially since in this case we're being told that the 2003 changes are dispositive as to the legislative intent back more than a decade ago when the statute was originally drafted. And the question is, how can we ascertain legislative intent over a decade old based upon a committee report in 2003. Is legislative intent that static? And is it possible for a committee in 2003 to really solidly ground this court's jurisprudence based upon its opinion of what happened over a decade prior? And I think the answer to that is, I don't see how this court can rely upon that. I think it's, you know, frankly, sort of fiction that we engage in to impute any sort of sense to the legislature from one session to the next, because they do change their minds. And in fact, that was demonstrated in this case. We're talking about a question of politics from one to the other. So we really have to get down to what was the original meaning. And of course, the issue in dealing with legislative intent, as this court has noted, really comes down to what's the meaning of the words and not what people thought they were doing in their heads. It's what they wrote down on the paper. And in this case, the court construed that in 2002. The fourth court did the same in 2000. And the court in Texarkana, I think, did it in the Van Liner case in 1996. So there has been some consistency in the court prior to that time. The other cases which have been cited, for example, there's the Medina versus Herrera, the Texas Workers' Compensation Insurance Fund versus Simon. None of those cases actually dealt with the 7-day pay or dispute provision. They mentioned in passing the 60-day requirement. In Medina versus Herrera, it was an exclusive remedy case, and so there was really no direct bearing on the outcome there. And in Simon, it was more a question of the adequacy of the dispute, and so no party ever put into play the 7-day pay or dispute provision. So in looking at this, the courts have spoken with one voice, and you're being asked to change that voice now. And I think that there is no warrant for doing that based either upon the legislative history in this case or the court developments that we've seen. Now, there is an issue in this case.
By the court developments, you mean changing of personnel? What do you mean? I don't understand.
Yeah, I'm talking there about the decision in Van Liner in 96, the 2000 Fourth Court, and the 02 Supreme Court decision. In all those cases, we see a consistency in what the courts have done, and there's really nothing but dicta, as it were, on the 7-day provision prior to that, or other than that, in those other cases that I've mentioned. And in fact, they don't even discuss the 7-day provision, because it's critical here, as was noted by the petitioner, that the Workers' Compensation Commission never required, or at least in the facts of this case, in the rule in effect, Rule 132.17, never required action on a death benefits claim within 7 days. I got kind of confused by that when I first looked at it, because there is a 7-day provision in there, but that 7-day provision doesn't refer to from date of notice to date of payment. It deals with issues regarding beneficiaries and subsequent developments. So you have to ask the question, well, why should we give deference to the legislature, to the commission's interpretation, when the commission has both shown itself to be unreliable in other cases and when the commission has basically disregarded the statute on any theory? I mean, under the statute, you have to ask something of a carrier within 7 days. And if the rule doesn't do that at all, I don't think the rule is a valid shelter, because it's not a reasonable construction of the statute. And so, given that the Workers' Comp Commission never gave a reasonable construction of the statute to this court, the court was reasonable in construing the statute to require action in 7 days and require that action to be payment of benefits or dispute.
Well, in all fairness, though, when they amended the act in 89 or 90, they put a lot of power and a lot of emphasis on the commission, did they not?
Absolutely, and that's why I think it's critical.
The rulemaking power, and they go through the process and publish it. So in all fairness to the carrier, you did have a commission with those rules. Let me ask you a question, though, if I might go back to the 7-day. The statute says here that they pay or dispute within 7 days of written notice. Would you help me out in this case with what was the written notice given to the carrier?
There was what we call an E-1, which was the employer's report of the injury.
And does that give the survivor?
I don't recall in this case if it lists them or not.
Okay, and then when did the surviving husband file a claim?
I did look at that. I don't know when SBC Texas got that claim. I can tell you that I believe it was signed by Mr. Mitchell, if memory serves, on September 13th.
But this one, even if he did not file a claim within 7 days, if the survivor did not and the E-1 were filed, that does have certain information on there in regard to who the employee was.
It's going to list the employee, the nature of the injury, to whom it was reported.
Or the alleged injury.
Yes, yes. It'll basically lay out what the facts of the employee's relationship to the employer, in other words, who they are and what they do, the alleged facts surrounding the injury, any witnesses, and the nature of the injury. Is it a death? Is it a lost time case? And so forth. And I don't know if that's in the record. It was in the record before the trial court, but I don't think it's been directly before you.
Any further questions?
If I might briefly respond to some of Justice Johnson's questions, and I have three quick points I'd like to make as well. Concerning the 7-day deadline, it is a pay or dispute deadline. So in a lot of instances, a carrier can't pay within 7 days, but
to the impossibility question. You get an E-1, and does that E-1 contain, in regard to a death case, the names of the beneficiaries or the surviving spouse or whoever?
No, and in fact, in this case, what happened was that Mrs. Mitchell became sick and was admitted to the hospital. Southwestern Bell received the notice of injury on August 23rd of 2000. Mrs. Mitchell died 4 days later, so the initial notice of injury was just for an occupational disease.
Does that not suffice to give notice of the death, or does it have to be another notice of the death?
Yes, and then the employer gets another notice of the death, and in this case, and then what happens eventually later on is there's yet a separate notice when the legal beneficiaries step forward and they say, yes, we're the ones that have the right to the benefits. And in this case, it wasn't until October 27th that Mr. Mitchell actually filed his claim for death benefits. And that would have been the first thing that could have potentially triggered Southwestern's Bell's duty to pay benefits. You'll find that in the clerk's record at 48. So that is in the record.
It's in the clerk's record. The E-1 is in the clerk's record?
That should be in there as well, but there's a reference in an affidavit to the date on which Mr. Mitchell filed the claim for death benefits.
Okay, but they had written notice before that.
Yes. Okay. First there's the written notice of the injury, then the notice of the death, and then ultimately the claim. There are three separate notices. To what I consider to be the three crucial issues here. First, concerning stare decisis, which is an important concern of this court. As this court has previously recognized in the Leos case, in a statutory construction case, the court's concern to effectuate the legislature's intent must trump its concern to follow precedent. As Justice Brister himself recognized in the previous case, a court in statutory construction cases is always bound by the legislature and not by its own precedent, and certainly not bound by precedent from lower courts of appeals that is either being appealed or has never been reviewed by this court. So I think that in the stare decisis context, stare decisis is only powerful in the statutory construction context when the legislature accepts this court's construction of a statute, because it's only under those circumstances that we can presume that the court has correctly ascertained the legislature's intent. I think that the circumstances of this case give us very compelling reason to believe that the legislature did not accept and, in fact, flatly rejected the court's holding in Downs.
What if this amendment had come 8 years down the road, 10 years down the road?
I still think it would turn on whether the amendment was a clarification.
And 10 years later, they clarified the intent of the legislature 10 years ago.
Well, and actually, I would make a distinction between, you know, sort of the idea that they're clarifying the intent of a legislature 10 years ago or that they're clarifying the meaning of the original statutory language that has been in continuous effect for the whole time. You know, again, I would feel slightly uncomfortable if the court were to just say, well, this legislature can't really determine what the law was. You know, we can determine what the law was more appropriately than this legislature can. This legislature is really construing the meaning of the language of the statute that has been in place for the entire time. And so I think that that's you know, made perhaps a difference. the clarification versus change, I think, is crucial. And the court hasn't had an opportunity to write on this aspect of statutory construction very often, but I think, you know, a lot of general principles apply. You start with the plain language, and according to that Axtell decision, you've got to construe the amendments, the additions to the statute, together with the original language. And I think if the court simply reads A1 and construes that together with the original language, the original language can then only have one meaning, and that is that a carrier does not waive its right to contest compensability if it misses the payer dispute deadline. Again, if the court disagrees, then the retroactive holding is always something that we could get relief on. So you start with the plain language, but you also consider the circumstances under which the legislature made the amendments. And I was going to cite one Fifth Circuit case that might be helpful.
Submit
that
in writing.
I will. Thank you.
That concludes this cause and all causes for the morning, and the marshal will now adjourn.